You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Hello, and welcome to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Thank you all so much for making time to join us this afternoon. My name is Karen Stevenson, and I serve on the Board of Directors of the Library Foundation. In addition to that, I also serve as a United States Magistrate Judge for the Central District of California here in Los Angeles. So I have to give a disclaimer that my introductory remarks today and the views of our presenters do not reflect the views of the United States Court or any members of our court. That said, I am a strong advocate and ambassador for the Los Angeles Public Library and libraries across the nation that open their doors to provide extraordinary access to all our citizens and to allow for education, understanding, and resources that our communities so need. I am very pleased to participate in various areas of the library and the foundation's work. The Library Foundation of Los Angeles is a nonprofit organization that provides vital support to the Los Angeles Public Library and presents a variety of programs, including the Aloud series that you are tuning into today. While our physical libraries here in Los Angeles remain closed to the public, the Los Angeles Public Library continues to provide vital services in our community. During the pandemic, the library has seen record levels of requests to check out ebooks and audiobooks and has continued to provide access to the library's online learning resources for students in grades K through 12. So while the doors aren't open, the library is very active in our community. We'd like to thank all of our supporters, especially our Library Foundation members, enable us to bring this type of programming to you. If you'd like to learn how you can support the library, please visit lfla.org/support. That's lfla.org/support. Your membership can make a great impact on our local communities across Los Angeles. This afternoon's program is very exciting as it's the first in Aloud's Power and Value series. The Library Foundation is presenting this series to engage in conversation with a range of experts in order to explore and examine how forces of power and value create and control our social narratives. The series will explore the complexities of how these two forces affect who and what matters in our society. It is well documented that much of the nation's wealth is narrowly concentrated, leaving many trying to survive below the poverty line or at best on the economic margins. This economic inequality in many ways reflects a hierarchy of power that favors the wealthy. What does this hierarchy do to our society? What are the implications of it for our democracy? We're going to discuss this further in today's program, and let me introduce our guests. Reverend William J. Barber II is an American Protestant minister and political activist. He is a member of the NAACP board and a chair of its Legislative Political Action Committee. While I can share a lot more about his background and career, let me just say that his impressive work will lend itself to a lively discussion this afternoon. Also joining us is Professor Robert Reich, an American economist, professor, author, and political commentator. He served in the presidential administrations under Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, and Bill Clinton. In addition, he served as the United States Secretary of Labor from 1993 to 1997, and he is the author of his newest book, The System: Who Rigged It, How We Fix It. I hope you are looking forward to this remarkable conversation as much as I am. Thank you again for joining us, and please enjoy the program. I'll turn it over to our presenters.
Well, Judge Stevenson, let me thank you, and I also want to extend my appreciation to Reverend Dr. William Barber, who is one of my heroes. His steadfastness, his courage, and his insight in terms of what's happening now in America, given the subject of this program, power and values, but also his leadership for many, many years, has just left an enormous impression, not only on me, but on millions of others. And so, Reverend Barber, I'm so delighted to be able to talk with you and pick up a conversation that we've actually started a while back. And every opportunity I have to continue that conversation, I consider to be a real blessing. How are you?
I'm well. And Brother Wright, let me thank you for your work as both an author and activist. We like to call you a footnoted fighter. You make sure that we all have the right footnotes. You know, the worst thing you can do is be loud and wrong. And so we thank you for being consistent and courageous in this moment to challenge the inequalities in our system. I would like to make a slight correction. Thanks, Honorable Judge Stevenson, so much. I am not the legislative chair for the NAACP board anymore. I was, but my work now is as co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, which my co-chair Liz Theohash has over 46 state coordinating committees now and hundreds of thousands of people connected. And I'm the president, senior lecturer of Repairers of the Breach, which focuses on moral articulation, moral analysis, and moral fusion building movement, moral action. So I just want to say that for the audience. Thank you so much.
Well, maybe we could take up right there, Reverend Barber, because your fusion of power and morality is something that it seems to me it lies very, very much at the center of the American dilemma right now, because you are living through, and I am living through, and the many people who are watching are living through a time when power seems to be misaligned with a lot of the fundamental American values. I don't want to sound partisan. I want to respect many people who are watching who may be Republican and followers of the president. But frankly, I've never lived through a time in which a president of the United States seems to be excusing, if not justifying, violence by white people against many people, including people who are protesting violence by the police against black people. I don't know whether you have lived through anything like this, but how do we respond? How do good people, moral people, respond to what we are seeing and hearing about every day?
Well, we have to be honest about the history. And Neil Painter at Princeton said something 3 years ago. She's a historian. She said, the current reality that we see in the White House is the iconography of a too often repeated American phenomenon. We take some steps forward and then there's a violent push backwards. This is not new. If you talk to any African-American person or white person that's been in the justice movement, or Latino person or Native person, is a part of the American ethos. We have to own it. It's not what we should be based on what we say on paper, but it is, as Michelle Obama said, it is what it is. But on the other hand, history also teaches us there's always been a response. The abolitionists responded by coming together, black and white, and deciding that they would build a movement rooted in our deepest religious values and our deepest constitutional values to correct, to challenge the ugliness of slavery. In the after slavery, black and white people, free issue blacks, former slave, poor white folk came together in the South and formed the Reconstruction Movement under the watch of the military, but a Reconstruction Movement that said, we are going to change these Southern constitutions. We're going to implement a 14th Amendment, equal protection of law, 15th Amendment, right to vote. We're going to implement a Civil Rights Act of 1875. Now it was overturned by what Neil Painter called an iconography of a too often repeated American reality in 1877. The early union movement had this deep moral move, proportion, the social gospel movement, black and white people like A. Philip Randolph connecting with white labor leaders. The civil rights movement was deeply, even before we get to the 50s and 60s, I wish people knew more about the stories of black and white people forming organizations that are working together in Montgomery and Selma before the spark happened. And so we know what we have to do. We have to have an intersectional response. Dr. King said the only people that could ultimately restructure the American society like it should be would be for Black people, poor people, including white people, welfare recipients, labor leaders, and moral leaders to come together into an intersectional moral force that challenged what we say today are the interlocking realities of injustice, which is systemic racism, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, denial of health care, the war economy, and this false moral narrative, religious nationalism, and white evangelicalism.
Well, the question that is on my mind is how we come together when there is so much effort by those who have power in our society to drive us apart. That is, you know, as I look historically at what has happened, not only in terms of racism, but also in terms of class and money and power in America, the story is very much a story of the 1880s, 1890s, early 1900s, the first Gilded Age, in which what you had was people who were very powerful driving a wedge between the white and Black working classes. You have the same thing today. But what the powerful seem to want to do, I use the term oligarchy, but what the powerful seem to want to do is use racism and xenophobia as a means of getting us so angry at each other that we don't look up and see where the actual power and wealth have gone in society. So we don't come together. So we don't use our majority, our vast majority, and we don't feel our power to take back the economy and also our democracy. As the great Justice Louis Brandeis said in 1923, at the closing days of the first Gilded Age, he said, look, we have a choice in our society. We can either have great wealth in the hands of a few, or we can have a democracy, but we can't have both. And he might have as well have been talking about racism and everything else. That is, everything is related to everything else. But how do we, at a time like this, Reverend Barber, get people to understand their commonality and the need for people to come together?
You know, right, you're exactly right, Brother Wright. This is, it's not new. And there's always been this attempt. And it's not just an attempt, it actually works, it's poison. But we also have examples of it not working. And we also know, there's a professor that was once at Union, Union Theological Seminary, that preached a sermon entitled, The Blessing of an Enemy. And he said, your enemy often tells you your strength. Now the question is whether or not you recognize it. Because you have to recognize if somebody's working this hard, you think about what's going on now. If people are working this hard to lie, to do everything they can, then they must be afraid of something. Dr. King said at the end of the Selma to Montgomery March, something we don't often hear, he said that the bourgeois class, the aristocracy, will always sow racial division at the very time the poor and Black white people have the power to transform society and build a more just society. We are at that moment now. So the first thing is we have to loose ourselves from that false reality that they are the powerful and recognize we actually have power. That the truth of the matter is, let's take for instance voting power. Right now, we just did a study called Unleashing the Power of Poor and Low-Wealth People. Poor and low-wealth people now make up 25% of the electorate. In 16 states, if you just registered 1 to 19% of poor and low wealth people around an agenda of justice, they could fundamentally shift the electorate in the Senate, in the presidential race, gubernatorial races. And I'm talking about states even in the South that often are written off. They do not need to be written off anymore. The question is, the point is we have to organize in that way, which is why the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, we see that power. So we've been organizing and we're pulling people together in those areas to say, the question is not what others have done, but what is it that we can do? We call it, we must do more, mobilizing, organizing, registering, educating people to vote. June 20th, Brother Wright, we had 3 million people that showed up online for our Mass Poor People's Assembly Moral March on Washington. On the 14th of September, we're bringing together millions of those same people to train them on voter protection and voter participation. Why? To say, did you realize, for instance, in Michigan, if just 1% of poor and low wealth people across every race, creed, and color would organize, they changed the election there. In North Carolina, it's just 19%. In Florida, it's just 7%. And when we start saying that, people say to us, then we need to stop being afraid and start organizing. We need to start coming together around this agenda. We know it works. That's why every moral movement has either been shot or undermined, assassinated or undermined, because it works. You know, it worked during the New Deal. That's why there were attempts, you know, to shut it down. It worked during the Civil Rights Movement. That's why people were killed and assassinated. It wasn't that the movements just stopped. It is that there is this possibility to show people, as I often say, if you scratch a racist, you find a thief. In other words, you scratch a racist toward Black people and people of color, you'll find somebody who will also steal your living wages, even if you're white. They'll steal your health care, even if you're white. They'll steal your clean air, clean water, even if you're white. And when people began to see that, we can in fact be a part. I think this moment that we're in is really a test now for America, is whether this mighty majority of all of us, we the people, are going to decide forward together, not one step back, or if we're going to let a loud minority keep us divided and continue to move us away from the kind of justice we know is possible.
I think that's exactly right. And what I continue to see around the country and hear around the country is that there are a lot of working class and middle class and poor white people who are being held down because of racism. That is, it sounds ironic, it sounds paradoxical, but actually they are worse off because they are either falling prey to or susceptible to this kind of demagoguery that keeps everybody apart and keep everybody from exercising and enjoying the power that we would have together to raise all boats, to raise all people.
That's right. And let me give you a clear example of that, because we have to be careful even in a conversation about racism, because too often you say racism, people think the N-word or somebody, the way somebody feels in their heart. I often say that racism is not about what's in your heart, it's about what's in the heart of your policies. Because no racist will ever call themselves a racist. And somebody in this city, they may never call you the N-word. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is, for instance, let's take one area of racism. Let's take two areas. For instance, police violence toward Black people, the shooting and the killing of Black people. When that happens and there creates a distrust between the community and policing, it undermines the good policing. It undermines safety and security in the community. And once you allow police, a rogue police or whoever they are, to feel they have the license to kill people without any consequences, don't forget a few years ago in the 30s and 40s, it was police connecting up with white mobsters killing people. You see, once you loose that, it can have an impact on everyone. Now, and take the other area, voter suppression. We know that every state that is a voter suppression state is a high poverty state, a low wage state, an anti-union state, a denial of healthcare state. And we know that every state that is a voter suppression state has more white people that are poor and low wealth and need those things than Black people in terms of raw numbers. We also know when we track it that persons who engage and support racist voter suppression, once they get elected, they pass policies that block living wages and health care that hurt mostly white people. For instance, in my state of North Carolina, we had a group of racist voter suppressionists who happened to be Republicans. They passed voter suppression laws. Now, it took us 6 years to overturn them. The court said it was surgical racism. But before they were overturned, those laws had impact to suppress the vote. They got elected through racialized gerrymandering. When they got elected, the first thing they denied, Robert, was Medicaid expansion. They said, but when we looked at the numbers, guess what? 500,000 people were denied Medicaid expansion, but 346,000 of them are white. And when we started showing people that in North Carolina, that's how the Moral Money movement began. Because people say, wait a minute, these folk have lied to us about fraud. Their argument about fraud is fraudulent. They've gotten elected. Now they are hurting all of us. And so racism equals thievery. Racism equals death. Racism is another part of what we call necropolitics, that people use racism. And when I'm talking about strictly policy racism to get power. And when they use that power in a way that hurts everybody. If you keep the wages down in the black community, you hurt the wages in the white community. If you allow people to hire people for less wages over here, it hurts wages across the board. And so what we have to always do in America is keep the fight against systemic racism and systemic poverty united. Absolutely. That's why the March on Washington was never just a march for Kumbaya. It was never just a one-issue march. It was a march for jobs and freedom. And it's why Dr. King that day, lastly, when he spoke, he couched his conversation in economic metaphors, whether it was about police brutality or voter suppression or wages. He said, we've come to cash a check. And too often this comeback marked insufficient funds. That was genius by Dr. King to say that we take an economic metaphor and show racism and police brutality and the denial of jobs and living wages as forfeiting what is rightfully the right, not only of black people, but all Americans.
Amen. But here's the thing. When Dr. King was doing that and saying that and marching, it was in the late 60s. And what we've seen over the last 50 years is even more wealth and even more power going to the top. That is, we had a relatively equal society, although we did have a lot of racism and we did have a lot of people held back. But over the last 50 years, we've seen the growth of an oligarchy in America that is similar, again, to the oligarchy we had in the Gilded Age of the 1880s. We have seen so much wealth and so much power concentrated at the very top that unless middle class and working class and poor whites and blacks and Latinx and everybody else get together and understand their common interest in a democracy and an economy that work for everybody, we are going to see a vicious cycle in which the wealth and power at the top keep on grabbing more and more wealth and power because they are distorting our political process and thereby distorting the market. So here's my question to you, and it's something that this is why I absolutely love talking to you. I love talking to you for a whole variety of reasons, but one is because we get so quickly to the heart of the matter. And the heart of the matter is, how do we, all of us, explain, particularly to white working class and poor and white middle class people, that they have a huge stake in getting together with black and Latinx people and creating a combined unitary movement to take back our democracy and economy? How do we actually, and you've been doing it. You've been doing it. I just want to know, as a practical matter, how do you do it?
Well, that's one of the things too, I think when you made that statement for the last 50 years, let's deal a little bit with that to talk, because that'll inform what we have to do. First of all, we know that the movement was shot on one hand, assassinated, wasn't that it stopped. We know that the war on poverty was the war we walked off the field, and Donald Rumsfeld and the guy who used to be over the Pentagon, and Dick Cheney, were a part of the Nixon administration that tore down the Office of Economic Opportunity, tore down the war on poverty and instituted Nixon's strategy. And then of course Reagan comes along and we get through economics, right? Which is by intentionality, put more money at the top. And we've been under the weight of that blue economics and Reaganism ever since. And Democrats have made a calculated error, I believe, in buying into strict neoliberalism and believing that you can just lift the middle class, or saying that all that rising tides lift all boats, but as Jesse Jackson once said, but not if the boat is stuck at the bottom. And so what we moved away from is even having poverty and addressing poverty at the center of our political discussions, even though we now have 140 million Americans living in poverty and low wealth and growing. We had 43% before COVID, if you use the supplemental measurement, measurement. And now we're gonna be over 50%. And what's scaring me even now, Brother Wright, is even as this presidential campaign is going on, and while we are clear about the demagoguery, I am still troubled that Democrats can't just focus on poverty and low wealth, can't even say the word yet. Now, that has nothing to do with we're not gonna vote and push and all those kinds of things, but it's a mistake. You cannot ignore 43% of your nation. You cannot ignore 50% of your nation. So that those realities tell us a little bit about what we must do. First of all, we have to change the narrative. And the only way we're gonna change the narrative is what we're doing in the Poor People's Campaign, is that is putting a face on the numbers and making America see what these numbers look like. So that is why one of the first things we've done is we have pushed out the face of poverty, and we've pushed out these numbers, 140 million poor and low-wealth people, and we've then disaggregated those numbers, because too often we've acted as though poverty was just a marginal issue among people of color, to say, listen, 61% of those folk are Black, 61% of Black folk are poor and low-wealth, 37% of poor white people are poor and low-wealth, but that's 66 million white people and 26 million Black people. And when we do that, the more and more people are actually aghast. They say, what? I didn't know that. So you've got to change the narrative. You can't stay stuck in a narrative that's only about middle class and wealthy. And the poor and low wealth people have to force this into the political conversation. Second of all, you have to build power. That is why we are working hard in this election to make sure that the power of poor and low wealth people are felt at the polls, so that after the election, people understand that they have to respond to poor and low wealth people, the issues, because we have to build power. And right now, for instance, I was looking at the data today, Robert. Did you realize that if you take all the southern states from Maryland to Texas, that's 193 electoral votes. And in those states, two things have happened. Republicans have lied too much with the southern strategy and split Black and brown people from white people. And Democrats have retreated too much from the Southern strategy. Well, poor and low-wealth people are saying, okay, we're no longer gonna depend on you to organize us, we're gonna organize us. And we're gonna organize our power, because we can't wait on the system, political system, to create a movement. We have to create that movement with poor people, moral leaders, and other advocates. And that's what we have to do, change the narrative, build power, and then thirdly, we must put forth our own agenda, which is why we have put an agenda called the Moral Platform for the Healing of the Nation, that actually shows that addressing the issues of poverty and low wealth is good for the entire country, right? That we already have the money. We have to destroy the mythology that we do not have the resources. And then finally, we have to find political allies that will turn this agenda into bills and fight for them, not just write a bill just to say they wrote it, but actually fight for bills to be passed that can be transformed. For instance, lastly, if we instituted a $15 minimum wage, we could immediately take 49 million workers out of poverty and low wage, put $328 billion in the economy. If we had a housing wage, it would raise 83 million workers out of poverty and low wealth, and would create $1 trillion that would be pumped into the economy. We have to have that. So it's these five things that we have to do. We have to change the narrative. We have to build power. We have to exercise that power on our own terms and not wait on somebody else, and especially in these southern states. We have to have an agenda, and we have to have political allies that will begin to put this agenda on the floor and demand that they be addressed in this society. And especially if we get a new administration. We get a new administration, we don't want to hear, well, we can't do this. We don't know what we can do. They spent all the money. In the first 100 days, when you have over 50% of your people in poverty and low wealth, you have to address this issue.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the economics is on the side of every argument you just made, Reverend Barber. That is, we know that if you put more money into the pockets of people who are poor or near poor, they're going to spend it. And when they spend it, that creates more jobs and that creates more economic activity. One of the reasons this economy has been so fragile for so long is that you've got more and more wealth going to the top, but people at the top don't spend their wealth. They save it. They put it into what, paintings and stocks and bonds all over the world, but they're not actually multiplying that money in terms of jobs and good wages and the building of the U.S. economy the way poor people or had extra money. So that's a sort of a very basic economic reality. The other economic reality is that even if you're rich in this country, you would do better with a smaller share of the total economy because you will see more economic activity than if you just simply hold on to all your wealth, which was one big, big argument for public investment in education, job training, in infrastructure, research and development, our good schools, better schools, access to higher education. And it's also a very important argument for a good social safety net. I mean, European workers who have a much better social safety net than in the United States, they are actually doing better, not because of the social safety net, but they're actually more economically productive. You know, if you get paid sick leave, for example, you can be more secure in your job and you can be more productive in your job. That's what we're learning in this awful pandemic. The Europeans know how to do it. The South Koreans know how to do it. Many people around the country, around the world, have fought and actually contained the pandemic because the public sector is much, much more equipped to deal with these kinds of emergencies. Here in the United States, we celebrate this kind of rugged individualism, which translates into the harshest form of capitalism in the world.
And Brother Wright, what you get is not rugged individualism, it's just straight up greed.
Yeah.
and so as you're right, other countries, and I'm glad that you said it that way, because what gets in the way is always, it comes back to this racism. And that is that when you frame investments as helping those people, remember Lee Atwater said when he was doing campaign before he died, that he would do that. He said, we will talk about tax cuts and talk about entitlements and frame it in a way that makes poor and low wealth white people think that they are hurting because somebody else is getting something free. The way we have made too many, often we've allowed poverty. That's why Democrats can't keep running from it. We've allowed people to talk about poverty in ways that's so narrow, in ways that it's like it's a certain group of people, or a certain group of people who aren't doing this. That are lazy, that just don't want to move. All of that, all of those racial metaphors, when in fact 62 million people work every day in this country for less than a living wage. Racism gets in the way of us implementing policy. And then socialism, for instance, becomes a new term for racism. If you listen to it closely, and we have to recognize, you take somebody like McConnell. McConnell said recently to a group of people, he said, if everybody else goes down, if you all ensure that I am the Senate Majority Leader, I'm the Grim Reaper. I'm the Grim Reaper. I'll make sure none of this stuff comes to the floor. And restoring the Voting Rights Act and health care. So what we're now doing is we're organizing people from the hills to the hollow, from the hollow to the hood. In Kentucky, bringing together white and black folk from the mountains of Kentucky to the street corners of Louisville, who recognize that this man is caring more about the greedy and the wealthy than he is the poor and low wealth people of Kentucky. And every Monday we've been having something called the National Moral Monday March on McConnell's mayhem, meanness, and misery, and we had almost a million people show up over the last three Mondays, because people, I think what has happened in the midst of this COVID is that people are starting to realize in many places that not dealing with systemic racism and poverty are matters of national security. And while you might be able to kind of a rim it. You know, I'm going to used to have a tire and it would blow. You just rim it along. You can't rim this society along when in the midst of COVID. COVID is showing us, right, that what if we had dealt with these issues prior to COVID? But because we didn't deal with them, now it's causing even greater impact on our society. Then we turn around and pass a CARES Act and give 80% of the money to corporations and banks. And we're right back now needing to pass a HEROES Act. And then we have a Senate leader that says, I'm not even going to let you pass that until you guarantee that the corporations have liability. I need another quarter of $1 trillion in tax cuts. I need an F-35 fighter plane. While 30 million people are unemployed and 27 million more people have been added to the, have lost their health care. I think in the midst of this, and in the midst of all the, even the police death, that what George Floyd said, I can't breathe, has now become shorthand for what a lot of people are feeling, whether they're black or whether they're white or whether they're brown, not just because of the police's knee on their neck, but because of the policy knees that are on their necks that is literally creating death. Because that's the last thing we have to do, Rob. We have to expose that these bad economic policies, just like bad policing, causes death. People die. We did a, Columbia did a study a few years ago that said 700 people were dying a day from poverty and low wealth. Not natural death, from poverty and low wealth, the effects of poverty and low wealth. And we have to continue to show that. And that's one of the things we're doing in the Poor People's Campaign is exposing, and we have to do more of it. That's what you're doing, is that these policies are not benign. They're not just economic conversations, they're moral conversations, they're life and death conversations. And when people began to see that these inequities are literally causing death, then I think it encourages us to fight for life, to really organize, and I'm seeing it all around the country.
You know, it's amazing how the prospect of death really does concentrate the mind.
Exactly.
I mean, no matter how much Donald Trump is trying to get people to hate each other and trying to whip up a kind of almost a civil war, if not a race war, it turns out his polls are not going up because I think most people are saying to themselves, wait a minute, that's all an abstraction. When it comes to my health and the health of my loved ones and actually staying alive, I know what's happened to this country over the last 5 months, and I know that his malicious incompetence, and it can only be called malicious incompetence, has actually threatened the lives of myself and my loved ones. I think that has a huge, huge effect. You know, when you were speaking, I was also thinking about Ronald Reagan. And when Ronald Reagan, he did two things that set the table for what was to come. One thing he did was to talk about, and you remember this, he talked about welfare queens.
Amen.
He talked about black people, and he did the dog whistle of kind of black people are the ones who are taking welfare. And he made people forget that poverty was actually mostly a white problem in America. I mean, remember Harrington's book about the other America? That was about poverty. That was about white poverty and black poverty. But he made people forget that. And then he sold the toxic idea of trickle-down economics, which never had any basis in fact or in economics or in reality or in logic. But he sold the idea that if you make the rich richer and you cut their taxes, they somehow are going to help everybody do better. Well, it was a lie then. It's an even bigger lie today, because for the last 50 years, the median wage in the United States, adjusted for inflation, has not risen at all. And that's part of the, I think, that's something people have got to understand. We're all in the same boat, and that same boat has not been rising, even though the economy overall has been rising. You know, the richest 1% own half of all the stock market in the United States. The richest 10% own 92% of the stock market. The stock market is not America.
And the reason, and because you have that kind of gross inequity at the top, then it's clear why you can have a rising stock market where people are simply buying back their own stocks and taking tax cuts and buying their own stock, and then have a failing economy and have because it's the concentration of wealth here. Now, as a moral leader, I must say yes, Ronald Reagan did that, and he was he intentionally did it. In fact, he did it at Philadelphia, Mississippi, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
At the place where Swan, Chain, and Goodman were murdered. Now we have a president that's offering what I call wall-up economics. In other words, I just put a wall around it. So he wants to put a wall at the border, when in fact, if we took that $24 billion that they're trying to put in a wall and put it in K through 12 education, it would do much more benefit for the livelihoods of Americans. And then he wants to say, I'm gonna put a wall up between you and poor folk in the suburbs, which is another lie, because he acts as though the people who get low-income housing and housing vouchers are just black folk and just brown folk, when the large majority of them, in terms of poverty, are white and women. So we have to unmask these lies, Rob. That's one thing. Now, you can't play with a lie. You can't just dismiss a lie. You know, I'm waiting for a Democrat to take on somebody, I mean hard, when they call them a socialist, and say, no, what we're talking about is not continuing the reality of Reverend Lawson said at John Lewis's funeral, plantation capitalism, or capitalism gone crazy. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about a just and equitable capitalistic system. But in addition to that, I have to say that Democrats, when they get power, and if they get power again, are gonna have to act boldly, like an FDR and beyond, because FDR was responding to a particular moment. But we need a third reconstruction in our economics, in our social arena, in our civil rights laws. We need a third reconstruction. And this time, when Dems get power, they're gonna have to almost act like Republicans, not worry about so much the next election and just do what's right. Just do what's right.
Yeah,
and show people the rightness of it. We're gonna have to go to the South. You're gonna have to go down to the South and show people how they're being played against each other, but then show them how the policies that you're trying to implement are gonna change the lives for everyone. What we will not be able to do is wait on some things. Too much is at stake, and this pandemic has made change, transformation, reconstruction necessity in this moment. It's made a necessity in this moment. We cannot continue to be a society where the pyramid is faring all right. The tip of the pyramid, the top of the pyramid is faring abundantly well. But there are all these cracks and foundations in the foundation. Eventually the whole thing will implode. There's no way you can hold the cracks and breakages, which, by the way, as you know, Brother Wright, are unnecessary. We just proved, for instance, in COVID, I don't want another politician to tell me we don't have the money unless we raise taxes. First of all, we know where the money is. It's in our bloated military budget, but it's also available even beyond that, because I think I just saw the treasurer give, what, $1.2, $3 trillion? Didn't even go through Congress, just did it overnight, over a 48-hour period. And then another $2 or $3 trillion to corporations and banks. So actually, we have to talk about that. The lie has been exposed. Don't tell us we don't have the money. What you may have is only a desire to invest it upward. But the reality is we do have the money, and we're going to have to make the investments downward so that we lift everything up.
Now, this is a very critical point that people have got to understand. In addition to all of the other mythologies that you and I have been talking about, the myth that we have a dangerous federal debt or we have a dangerous federal budget deficit is itself a dangerous myth, because we're the richest country in the world. And if there was ever a time in our nation's history where the government needed to be the spender of last resort, it is now. When you have so many people who are either unemployed or in very, very deep difficulty. I mean, government has got to be there. We learned this in the 1930s in the Great Depression, and we have an economy now that is analogous to the Great Depression. And so we cannot tolerate anybody, Democrat or Republican, saying we don't have money or the cupboard is bare. It's not bare. It's full, and we've got to treat it as if, and understand that it is full. Reverend Barber.
Can I mention one thing on that? I want to do a little preacher analogy on that.
Yeah.
And that is, I cannot stand when people say, you need to treat the American budget like your household budget.
No.
First of all,
wrong.
You can't make money in your house. You don't have the constitutional authority to make money. If you try it, you'll go to jail. But secondly, if you have money in your house and you spend it out of the house, it doesn't come back to the house. In America, if you have deficit spending to create public infrastructure, public spending, the money stays in the house. It's not like it's going somewhere else. You up the house.
Yeah.
So the house becomes more valuable. And so we have, as again, but we've been sold these myths. And at times, to be quite honest, we haven't taken them on as strong as we should have. And the clergy and the pulpit hasn't taken them on. You know, one of the great differences in the movement of the Great Depression, when Roosevelt got involved, is that he had a social gospelist who was his labor secretary.
Francis Perkins, the great
Francis Perkins.
Yep.
And she said, I have come here to do the will of God. Now, she wasn't talking about a theocracy. What she was talking about is she knew, even when she put her hand on the Bible and swore herself an office, that our deepest religious values say, if a society wants to be great, care for the least of these, care for the poor. That is the key to greatness. That is the key to lifting the whole society. And so we need that. And that's why so much money was spent. Kevin Cruz has done a book on it called The Purchasing of the American Pulpit, One Nation Under God, where he actually shows how the business, the greed side of the business world that didn't want the New Deal, that called Roosevelt a socialist, that didn't want the minimum wage, that didn't want Social Security, went out and spent money and purchased pulpits and purchase preachers to come up with a misguided heretical form of theology that is still with us today. So when you see ministers that are able to go in and pray, P-R-A-Y, for a president who is praying, P-R-E-Y-I-N-G, on the poor and the least of these, they are operating in a myth, a form of theology that is as old as slave master theology, as old as the theology that was developed to stop Social Security, stop the New Deal, the theology that tried to stop the Civil Rights Movement, which then means people like me, clergy, we can't stay on the sideline in these issues. We have to speak in moral authority. Why?
I think it's exactly the same for people like me, who teach, we're in policy analysts, we've been in government and out of government, there is a kind of a parallel with regard to theology. And that is that you've got people who have made the market itself a kind of a religion. The notion that the market has some spiritual value. The market in reality is just a human creation. The market is changing over time as people and institutions and corporations with great wealth and power influence and alter the way the market is organized so that they can get even more wealth and even more power. Mm-hmm. Reverend Barber, I don't want to take any more of your time, and I certainly don't have too much time, and the people who have been watching us have been very tolerant, and we were supposed to take a lot of questions. And we've actually run out of time for even people's questions. But you know what? I think that listening to you and having an opportunity to engage in the kind of conversation that we've talked in about, and also talking about the mythologies, the critical, powerful, often dangerous mythologies that have disabled America from taking back our democracy and our economy, though that discussion is critically, critically important. And so
say one quick thing, because I would be remiss if I didn't. America, do not fall for this law and order rhetoric. That rhetoric was spoken against Martin King and Viola Wusa, a white woman who was killed at the end of the Selma to Montgomery movement march against John Lewis. It was used by George Wallace. There's a 1968 speech that George Wallace gave running for president that Trump ought to be charged with plagiarism. It's so exact that it's scary. And it was a way of distracting. Sure, we need safety and security. But violence, as Coretta Scott King, is also denying people health care, denying people living wages, denying people public education. Don't fall for this. It's a trick, it's a racist trick that is used by people who, once they get elected, are going to give more money to the greedy and steal your health care and steal your living wages. The second thing, the Attorney General said yesterday he didn't believe there was any racism, systemic racism, just a few bad characters. That's the same thing that was said by white supremacists in the 50s and 60s. George Wallace never said there was any racism. He actually said the opposite. There wasn't any racism. And to suggest there's no racism would mean that the Attorney General would also then say, the logic would say, we don't need the 14th Amendment, equal protection under the law. We don't need the 15th Amendment, a guarantee the right that nobody can abridge or deny the right to vote. We don't need the Civil Rights Act of 64. And just remember, black and white people and brown and all over the country, every civil rights provision in our Constitution and in our laws made it better for white people too. White women couldn't serve on juries until after the Voting Rights Act was passed. When Plessy versus Brown versus Board of Education turned over Plessy, it helped funding come to rural white schools. When the Civil Rights Act was passed and said you could not get federal money unless you welcomed everybody, a lot of white people benefited when hospitals and other entities received federal monies. We cannot in this moment be fooled by this racist attempt to cloud the real issues that are facing. And it's tragic that you would have people in office like an attorney general who would literally stand up and say, against all the evidence, that there is systemic racism. Systemic racism doesn't mean everybody is a racist. That's not what it's saying. It means that there are systems that are unjust and systems that are unequal, and they're hurting people in the society disproportionately. But we must understand what Robert Reich and I have tried to say today, and that is that systemic racism also leads to economic injustice for all people.
For all people.
And we have to remember that.
You know, Reverend Barber, you talked a moment ago about Philadelphia, Mississippi, and Ronald Reagan, and the civil rights workers who were slain in near Philadelphia, Mississippi. And it made me remember, because, you know, I'm very short and I was always bullied as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I found one older boy who was my kind of protector from the bullies. Mm-hmm. His name was Michael Schwerner. Mm. And Michael Schwerner, as you know, was one of the three civil rights workers, along with Cheney and Goodman, who were brutally tortured and murdered near Philadelphia, Mississippi, by the sheriff of Neshoba County and the Ku Klux Klan. And I'll tell you something, it was at that moment that I realized something very deep in myself, when I heard that my protector had been murdered mm-hmm. by the real bullies of society. What I understood in every bone in my body was that we are all together. Mm-hmm. We all have to fight the bullies. Mm-hmm. And the bullies are not just the violent, crazy people, but the bullies are economic bullies as well. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So what you and I are talking about is the gospel of really fighting bullies and taking power back that is rightfully ours.
Imagine, Brother Wright, if all of the families and the people that are deeply concerned and angry and upset about police killing of innocent people, that's a form of death, would connect to all the workers that have died, black or white, being forced into lethal situations. If all of those families come together and fight in this democracy, we can challenge and change the racism and the economic injustice. The forces that be don't want that. They don't want all of us who have experienced death to now join for life.
No, that's the whole point. They don't
that's
want
that's the whole point.
That's yeah. what they that's their greatest fear. Mm-hmm. And that is you know, Monday is Labor Day. Mm-hmm. And it's a day that we should be coming together around these fundamental economic principle that when we, the majority of us, do well, we all do well. When a minority of us do well at the top, we all do poorly.
Oh.
And Labor Day ought to be the kind of occasion for us to lift the veil on these kind of mythologies and understand what you and I have been talking about for the last hour. I want to ask Judge Stevenson, because with all apologies to her, we've been going over our time, and also to all of you out there, we didn't get to your questions. But Judge Stevenson, thank you, and I want to thank the Los Angeles Library Foundation for their time, and everybody who's tuned in for their time, and Reverend Dr. William Barber, bless you.
Bless you. Here comes the judge. I think we better get in.
Here comes the judge.
Thank you both, Professor Reich and Reverend Dr. Barber. This has been an extraordinary conversation, very insightful, and there is much for all of us to ponder as citizens in this season of discontent, as it were. I extend a special thanks to you both for your time, and to all of our members and those who are experiencing aloud perhaps this afternoon for the first time. We are very grateful that you joined us for this program. If you'd like to know more about the programs like this afternoon's and about the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, please consider becoming a member of the Library Foundation by visiting, as I mentioned before, lfla.org/support. And we look forward to seeing you at our next program, which will be entitled Media and Our Present Moment on September the 9th, featuring Sewell Chan, Brooke Gladstone, and Yamiche Alcindor. Thank you again, everyone, for your time. We're sorry we could not take all of your many thought-provoking questions, and we look forward to having you join the Library Foundation of Los Angeles for more of the Power and Value series. Thank you, everyone.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.